Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
All right, some commentators say whenever the Nazis are invoked, it's time to tune out. Whether it's calling Saddam or Ahmadinejad the new Hitlers, or comparing Bush and company to Weimar Germany, it's all hyperbole, so let's debate some other way. But my first guest this hour is jumping headlong into that fray. She is Naomi Wolf, who gained fame from her book, The Beauty Myth. She also, remember, gained fame for helping Al Gore pick his wardrobe.
Not true. We'll get to that.
But he won the popular vote. You should take credit for that.
We could discuss it later.
But she echoes his words, and that is, she has a new book echoing the words of Thomas Paine from the colonial era of this country, when he said, "These are the times that try men's souls." Her new book / pamphlet is called The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. She has studied the path that led from democracy to dictatorship in other societies like Weimar Germany and pre-Pinochet Chile, and warns that that's where we may be heading. A little later on, she'll compare notes with historian Eric Weitz, who has a new book about Weimar Germany. But Naomi Wolf, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's so great to be back here.
You didn't help Al Gore, Earth Tones, and all that stuff?
I helped Al Gore with women's issues and youth voter outreach. And a lot of what got dripped into the media stream was RNC urban legends. So no, I wasn't doing wardrobe consulting.
I stand corrected.
That's okay. It's a common misconception.
You're not helping any of the candidates this time?
I can't because of the American Freedom Campaign, which we can talk about, which is nonpartisan and is urging all the candidates across the board running for president to stand up for the Constitution and the rule of law.
By the way, this just in, and we'll try to get some details as we go, Israelis and Palestinians say they have reached agreement on a joint document. That doesn't mean a final peace agreement for the Middle East. That means, perhaps a roadmap or a menu of things that they're going to try to achieve. But Israelis and Palestinians say they have reached agreement on a joint document. That means some kind of joint statement that they will release at the Mideast Peace Conference in Annapolis. And Naomi, you gasp.
Well, I'm gasping with happiness because there's been so much bad news. It's wonderful to see a little light at the end of the tunnel.
So that just in from the AP, and that's really all there is right now. So if they trickle out the details of what's going to be in that document, of course, we'll bring it right to you since we've been talking about on the station all morning. But, Naomi Wolf, you have looked at historical examples and come up with the 10 steps to dictatorship, and we'll actually go down the list, and some of them are going to give you goosebumps. But what triggered your writing this book or pamphlet?
Yeah, well, I have a dear friend and a mentor who's the daughter of Holocaust survivors, and I'm Jewish myself, so as you rightly note, one does not go there lightly. But she and I would discuss current events, and she kept saying, as we would watch issues come up in the news, they did this in Germany, they did this in Germany. And I really disregarded her. I thought this was crazy extremist talk, but she kept saying they did this in Germany. And finally, she almost physically sat me down and gave me a stack of books and really forced me to start reading. And of course, she wasn't talking about National Socialist outcomes, the 38, 39, 40. She was talking very specifically about the early years, 1930, 31, 32, when Germany was, we often forget, a parliamentary democracy with a wide range of newspapers and political opposition and a constitution.
And Hitler was elected, for shame, for shame.
Exactly. And we also forget or tend not to think about how a small group of people systematically used the law to subvert the law quite legally. And so when I started to read about those early years, the pressure on a democracy and on a constitution, I really got chills because not only were similar tactics being reproduced today, but actual sound bites, phrases, literal translations, rationales, and scenarios from the early 30s in Germany were being reproduced today. And then, just to finish the scary thought, I went back and looked at other times and places where a would-be dictator sought to close down an open society or crush a democracy movement and saw that all such people do the same 10 things.
So here are the 10 things, and we'll get into Weimar Germany in a little more depth in a little while when Eric Weitz joins us, who's a historian of that era who has a new book. Okay, here are the 10 things. You ready? Invoke an external and internal threat. establish secret prisons. Sound familiar yet? Develop a paramilitary force. Blackwater, anyone? Surveil ordinary citizens. Infiltrate citizens' groups. Arbitrarily detain and release citizens. Target key individuals. Restrict the press. Cast criticism as espionage and dissent as treason. Didn't somebody write a book by that title recently? Subvert the rule of law is number 10. So, whoa.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Nevertheless, the road from what is happening right now in the United States, and you could plug things into all these things, establish secret prisons, not quite Guantanamo, but the rendition prisons, I guess.
Yeah, and by secret, I also mean unaccountable and outside the rule of law, and very often there will be a military commission system set up. Lenin pioneered it. Mussolini took a leaf from it. Hitler studied Mussolini. Stalin studied Hitler. What that means is a prison system where basically torture takes place, and it is not transparent.
Right. But nevertheless, these things are happening, and yet we have a democracy in this country.
We have a weakening democracy. What is really important for people to understand, and this is why it's so important to look at the historical record, this blueprint for closing down an open society, is that people have a misconception. I did, too, until I did all this reading, that you've got a democracy or you've got a dictatorship and that the one doesn't kind of bleed into the other. But in fact, you know, many societies close down not through a coup like the March on Rome or Pinochet's coup in 1973 or a Night of the Long Knives. Many societies close down through what Malcolm Gladwell would call a series of tipping points. And that's what we're seeing now, you know, in Germany and in Italy, actually.
But aren't we very far from tipping points despite these things? And, you know, as outrageous as some of those things may be, to tip into dictatorship, to drift toward military coup, mm-hmm. how close to those things do you think the United States could actually come?
Well, very, very close. We're a handful of arrests away right now. Basically, what I argue in the book is that all of the pieces are now in place for one of a handful of very plausible scenarios to take place, after which it is almost impossible for democracy to heal democracy. Let me give you some examples. The Military Commissions Act of 2006 made it legal for the state to torture prisoners. The White House soundbite is that they don't, but they do. So what most Americans don't realize is that right now, the President of the United States can say, Brian Lehrer, you're an enemy combatant. Naomi Wolf, you're an enemy combatant. And even though you and I are innocent U.S. citizens, he can take you or me or the person who just walked by outside delivering the coffee and lock us up in a 10 by 12 foot cell in a Navy brig for 3 years in solitary confinement. So this is unprecedented. And what this means is we've got to notice
that they could only do that if they designated us enemy combatants and we were not citizens of the United States.
That is not correct. You're misinformed.
Not correct?
Not correct. They can torture us in Guantanamo if we're not citizens of the United States. But U.S. citizens, three already, have been named enemy combatants, and it's a status offense. Bruce Fine, who worked for Reagan, he's a conservative, is horrified by this, as are many good people across the right and
right.
The left.
So the Jose Padilla case, for example, right?
Yeah, but he was a bad guy. The point is it's a status offense, and so the president can say anyone innocent, meaning, it's like Mother May I, if he says it, it's true, and they can't hold you there forever. They can't torture you, but psychiatrists know that prolonged solitary confinement makes mentally healthy people mentally ill. So my personal tipping point is when I, and in a closing society, what often happens is there will be a handful of arrests of highly visible people or prosecutions. Right now, some people who supported Democrats are in jail because of political prosecutions in Alabama. But what my personal tipping point will be is when I open the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal and I find that people that I identify with, journalists, editors, writers, have been named enemy combatants and are being held, or the Justice Department has threatened to prosecute journalists who disclose classified information, as all good journalists do, under the 1917 Espionage Act. And the last time that was widely used, it silenced dissent for a decade because people like Eugene Debs got 10 years in prison for giving a speech about the First Amendment. So those are those tipping points. Another tipping point is Defense Authorization Act of 2007. Most people don't realize that this gives the president the power to say, again, Mother May I, It's a public emergency. Just because he says it, it makes it true. And that gives him the power to federalize the National Guard, send the National Guard of Alabama to crack down, create a state of emergency here in New York over the objections of the governors of both states, and tell Congress about it after the fact, or deploy Blackwater, who are not answerable to the people. So these are very scary signposts.
Naomi Wolf is my guest on WNYC. Her new book is The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. And interesting that you use the word patriot. You're trying to take that back from the right?
Well, I don't think anyone has a monopoly over it. I'm trying to have it restore it to the founder's sense, which is people who stand up for the rule of law and for our republic rather than for blind support for anything an executive wants to do.
But when you worry about the end of our democracy, and yet you gave all those examples just now, Eugene Debs and other things, we've come back from that.
Exactly. Now, here are two differences. You're quite right, Brian, to point out that there have been many times of repression in our country, the Alien and Sedition Acts, when you could be put in jail for criticizing the President Adams.
Lincoln suspended his habeas corpus,
and 120,000 Japanese Americans were locked up, innocent Japanese Americans during World War II. And you're quite right that the pendulum has swung back. And after each of these times of repression, people have gone, oh, my goodness, we were crazy. Enough. Here, again, two differences. And again, I'm indebted to Bruce Fine for pointing this out initially. The first difference is that other wars have had ending points. The Civil War ended. World War II ended. And at that point, society kind of stabilizes and goes, okay, well, we went crazy with war hysteria. The quote-unquote war on terror, and many leaders like Gordon Brown of England have pointed out that terror is a crime, not a cause. But Bush's quote-unquote war on terror, a hyped war, will never have an ending point the way he's constructed it. It's global in space. The whole globe is a battlefield. And it's endless. It's eternal. It's open-ended in time. There will never be a day of surrender when the American people can say, okay, no more crazy dictatorial war powers for you, Mr. President. The second difference is even more profound. I like to believe that if I had been targeted in the red-baiting hearings of HUAC, of the McCarthy era, I would have stood up to the McCarthy red-baiters like Lillian Hellman did or Arthur Miller, because the worst you could lose was your job. Never before have we tortured people in America. Never before have we tortured people legally in America. And this is a complete tipping point because if people who stand up to the state are now facing 3 years in solitary confinement and the increasing brutalization of citizens, I just saw a video of a speeder being tasered in Utah, just like the kid who was tasered in Florida and the woman who was tasered to death in Arizona. These incidents are ratcheting up. There's a blogger in prison in San Francisco. Greg Palast was investigated by Homeland Security and so on and so on. Once the state starts to use terror against an individual, that is what I call a fascist shift. And there is not the kind of turning back then. Democracy cannot be robust to heal itself in that case.
Naomi Wolf is my guest. Her book, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. You're already getting our phones and comments page buzzing. Our lines are already full at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You can post to our comments page, which always has room at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, see what other people have already put up there. And when we return in a minute, we will add Eric Weitz to this conversation. He's the author of a new book on the history of Weimar Germany, and we'll see how close he thinks the comparisons are, and then we'll take your calls and comments. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And WNYC continues to bring you every major presidential debate. Next one is tomorrow night. That's the Republican YouTube debate. We'll have it at 10 o'clock tomorrow night on AM 820 WNYC, courtesy of CNN. My guest right now, Naomi Wolf, author of The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. And Naomi, you studied many historical examples of democracies that became dictatorships, but you seem to find the most echoes in Weimar, Germany. So we have invited University of Minnesota Professor of History Eric Weitz, author of a new book called Weimar Germany, Promise and Tragedy, to join the conversation for a while. Professor Weitz, welcome to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
And I know you've been listening to Naomi Wolf. In general, do you think that the comparisons that she's drawing are apt.
I think Naomi Wolf has done a great, great service by pointing out the very dangerous erosion of civil liberties over the last number of years in the United States. However, the context, the comparison of Weimar Germany and the United States today is a bit strained, I have to say. The context is so very different. Weimar Germany was the site of great democratic achievements. It was the most democratic system that Germans had ever experienced to that point. But everything about the democracy was contested and conflicted from its very birth in the revolution of 1918-19.
So, in other words, and we have a comment to that effect, kind of to that effect on our comments page, Naomi, somebody writes, yes, this is worrisome, but Germany did not have the long and entrenched democratic tradition that we have here in America.
Right. May I respond to the professor? Professor, you're absolutely right. And, of course, you know, even though it was a high point for German democracy, it was, of course, a fragile democracy, and Germany didn't have our deep history of having built a republic. That said, I'm not making an apples-to-apples comparison. I'm looking at a comparison in tactics. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't use Germany alone. That's why I also look at Italy, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, China, and Pinochet's Chile, and all around the globe. Even today, you can see how the same 10 steps are basically used by petty dictators, emulating the blueprint in very different times and places that the great dictators like Mussolini, Stalin, and Hitler developed in the first part of the last century. So you're quite right that the groundings are vastly different, but the fact is that there are only a few key ways to close down an open society. And even if you're looking at, look at Russia or look at Pakistan right now, those are societies that are struggling to become more democratic, and you see the same 10 steps happening because they use the blueprint when they want to crack down. So
Professor Weitz, go ahead.
Yeah, I think your argument is very, very well taken, that democracies rarely fall from frontal assaults. They are eroded from within. And I think the analogy with Weimar Germany is a little bit different than the one you have articulated in the book and just now. The established right in Weimar Germany made the Nazis, it's a nice German word, salonfähig, which in essence means made them acceptable in polite society. And indeed, the German people did not elect the Nazis to power. At the very end, they were brought to power. Power was handed over to them by a very small group of very powerful men around the president, Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg.
Who were not even Nazis,
precisely. And I think that's, to me, that's the most important lesson, and
so
that's
important.
The most important analogy.
That's
where people have to look very carefully. When the established right makes the extreme right acceptable, takes up their ideas, brings them into the political process, gives them offices, then I think we have to look very, very carefully.
And can't
so
I ask?
Let's take a phone call. Cameron in Manhattan. Cameron, you're on WNYC.
Hi, good morning, Brian. I'm listening to Ms. Wolf speak, and she makes this country scarier than Iran. and I've lived in both countries. She's way, way off base. I mean, she forgets that half of the city was set on fire on September 11th. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. In about 13, 14 months, we're going to have a new government. Mm-hmm. It's not even close. She's way off base.
Okay, may I respond? Thank you so much for that call. This is what I love about a democracy. As long as it's vibrant, people can exchange differing points of view. One thing I wanted to chime in to the last comment by the professor, and it's relevant to the caller too, is how did the National Socialists consolidate their power? There was a, some say, hyped or staged terror attack on the Reichstag, which is the equivalent of Congress. And then in the wake of that, there was a an intimidation of representatives across the political spectrum, and they were told, you've got to pass the Enabling Acts, you've got to pass Clause 2, and what do? These restrict civil liberties. So Germans were told, we can read your mail, we can open your telegrams, we can listen in on your phone calls. And the representatives, who are not even Nazis, mostly signed up for this and disemboweled their own constitution out of fear of being seen as unpatriotic.
So just to be clear, you're not suggesting that 9/11 was staged, just that the reaction to it with the Patriot Act and the surveillance programs and things like that are reminiscent, correct?
I'm not suggesting that 9/11 was staged. I am noting that there is a long history both in this country with COINTELPRO and around the world of would-be dictators hyping or making use of a real threat. And that's what happened in Germany. And the outcome is what I think the professor is right to be calling our attention to, that good people can disembowel their own constitution, opening the door for horrors to come.
Right. But remember, after the Nazis take power, all of this happens in the context of the Nazis moving to establish a racial state. That is, a state and society that would absolutely privilege so-called Aryans and would persecute and ultimately annihilate the other.
And that's, of course,
well, what about the immigration anxiety that we're seeing today, Professor? Any parallel there? I mean, they're not trying to create, you know, nobody's trying to create an Aryan state in the sense of Nazi Germany at this point. But look at the Minutemen. Look how big an issue this is supposed to be in the 2008 presidential election.
Sure. There are parallels. There's no question about it. And democracy is always a fragile construction. And I think Naomi Wolf, again, does us a great service by pointing out how fragile democracy can be and how important it is always to defend democracy. And we can see examples of extreme right-wing ideas and activism all over the United States. And some of these ideas and policies have indeed infiltrated our own governmental policies. And that should give all of us pause and a great deal of caution. But I don't think the United States is headed right now toward an absolute dictatorship or toward a racial state. American democracy is far more resilient, far more deeply rooted than democracy was in Germany in the 1920s and 1930s.
My guest on WNYC, Naomi Wolf, who has written The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, and Eric Weitz, who has written Weimar Germany, Promise and Tragedy. And Rich in Red Bank wants to quote Goering from the Nuremberg Trials.
That's
is that
correct.
Right, Rich? Go ahead.
Yeah, excuse my voice. I have a cold.
Mm-hmm.
His thing is, of course, the people don't want war, but after all, it's the leaders of the country who determine the policy. And it's always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it's a democracy, fascist dictatorship, parliament, or communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to great danger.
Yeah, for once, Goering was right.
One of the most famous passages of the 20th century, and Rich, thanks for bringing it up. It's very apt here. And, Professor, I think one of the things that you and Naomi actually agree on, listening to the two of you, is that the threat to democracy actually comes from people saying that they're trying to protect our country.
Correct.
And standing
Correct.
Up for the values that they say the country represents, you know, rather than, let's say, Al-Qaeda coming in and imposing it from outside.
Exactly, right. And that always works. I just wanted to ask Professor Weitz what he thought. You know, there are about 25 examples in The End of America of actual phrases that seem to have been lifted straight out of Nazi documents, Nazi propaganda, things like Heimat, homeland. The practice Goebbels pioneered of embedding journalists, Leni Riefenstahl was embedded, we embed, they unloaded coffins at night, we unload coffins at night. They said way to invade Czechoslovakia, a country they were not at war with because it was a staging ground for terrorists and they were abusing their ethnic minorities. When the WMD charge vanished, we said, oh, we've got to invade Iraq, a country we're not at war with because they are a staging ground for terrorists and they're abusing their ethnic minorities, on and on and on. I mean, even things like, you know, Goebbels purged the civil service of lawyers. You know, the contested White House emails are going to show that the White House considered purging the civil service of lawyers. So what do you think of this? What do you make of it?
I'm not arguing with you about those particulars that you pull out. Some of them are very compelling and very scary indeed. I would differ with you, though, again, about the larger context, where the way in which those kinds of actions in the 1930s, those in Germany, those kinds of repressive actions were all part of a much larger project that, without question, was not democratic whatsoever, were all designed to create an absolute dictatorship, and beyond that, were all designed to prepare Nazi Germany to go into war and then conduct greater persecutions in the context of warfare.
Shall I tell you what I'm most scared of? Granted, everything you've just said, what I'm most scared of is looking at Italy and Germany and how easily, when you've got a paramilitary force that's not answerable to the people, like the black shirts, and then the brown shirts that were modeled on the black shirts, I lie awake nights worrying about Blackwater, because most people don't know. I mean, they know they're operating outside the rule of law in Iraq and that they've got close ties to Homeland Security and to the White House, but most people don't realize that Eric Prince hand-selects torturers and murderers from countries like Chile, El Salvador, who practice torture of their own citizens. Yeah. And most people don't realize that tomorrow we could wake up and find Blackwater patrolling the streets of New York, and coercing citizens who are engaged in anti-war protests.
That's are we really going to wake up tomorrow and find Blackwater patrolling the streets of New York?
Brian, I don't think you've heard what I've been hearing across the country. Blackwater, first of all, was first boots on the ground in New Orleans in the wake of Katrina, and Jeremy Scahill reported that contractors were shooting at civilians. Blackwater just opened a facility in Illinois. And Blackwater is trying hard to open a facility in San Diego and to develop a presence along the border and get into homeland border patrolling. And if you look at their website, I just blogged about this, they've got their eye on, yes, protests in Midtown Manhattan and, quote-unquote, threats to private aircraft, meaning absolutely nothing in the law. Wait, and their business model calls for continued expanded deployment in the United States. So they are planning to be on the streets of New York,
Professor,
and they're already on the streets
Professor
of New York.
Professor Weitz, you write in your book that one of the big problems during the Weimar period was the lack of consensus over how to solve problems.
Right.
Do you think we're approaching that level of polarization?
We are. We're not quite there yet, but there is this, without question, this depolarization in the United States, which is worrisome. One of the things I write about in the book is the way that every single issue in Weimar Germany, whether it was sex or the eight-hour day, became virtually an existential political struggle.
So interesting.
About the very essence of how to move forward, how to forge a new society. And when every single issue has that kind of weight to it, that is expressive of a lack of a consensus, and a democracy cannot survive without that. The Blackwater example, I think, is the biggest scandal in this country since we learned about the torture in Abu Ghraib. It seems to me that a democracy cannot outsource its military force. A democracy cannot outsource the protection of its diplomats abroad to a private military force. That's a total scandal. And I would hope that in the next election, a new Congress would shut down all these contracts with paramilitary forces like Blackwater.
Yeah, well, in fact, you know, talk about polarization. Naomi, here's a succinct question on our comments page. It says, well, won't all comparisons stop as soon as Obama gets elected? And so let me broaden that and say, if any Democrat gets elected.
Well, let me say that the last step is, step number 10 is subvert the rule of law or make it easier to declare martial law. So I'm very sorry to say that based on the historical blueprint, we're naive to think that we're going to be looking at a transparent, uncontested election in 2008. The historical blueprint predicts that the months leading up to a national election and a closing society are likely to show hyped threats, provocations, acts of instability, agents provocateurs who provoke violence to give the state an excuse to crack down, delay elections, subvert elections. And even as we said earlier, it's pretty easy in a closing society if you've got your own guys in the decision-making roles to have an election, but it's a corrupted election. Hitler had elections. I mean, the Austrians voted 99% ja for their own annexation because the SA were outside, of the voting booths menacing them. One of these scenes you saw.
Corrupted elections is one debate. You're actually laying out a scenario where if there's some kind of other attack, and it sounds like you fear that there might be even a staged attack, that Bush would Musharraf style impose martial law? Is that what you're saying?
I think Professor Weitz wants to say something.
Thanks. But think about a German man and woman born on the turn into the 20th century. Think of what those people experienced. Three huge social crises, World War I, the hyperinflation of 1923, and then the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in American experience comparable to living through three social crises that completely upended people's expectations, hopes, aspirations. that contributed to the deep fragility of democracy in Germany in the 1920s and early 30s. As great as the democratic achievements were in that period, which is what my book is mostly about, we don't have that kind of experience. Democracy, I at least hope, is much more firmly rooted in the United States.
And it's much more firmly rooted. And let me be super clear that I, again, am not trying to draw a societal analogy. I'm trying to draw lessons, things to learn from the past, to avoid them in the future.
We did have here in New York Rudy Giuliani try to delay the election by 3 months because only he could rule after 9/11.
Emergency. Let me also just say France. Okay, France is just about as old a democracy as we are. They practically invented democracy. And at least twice in their history, you know, their democracy was crushed and they had to push back and reestablish it again.
Peter in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. I have one point to make which really undermines her entire premise, which he fails to mention, which is firearms ownership and the right to keep and bear arms, and the disarming of the public, which your compadres, Clinton and Gore on the left, are really the ones who promote that. And the Weimar Republic, one of the first things that Hitler did was disarm the people.
You're absolutely right. And I have to say I'm much less of a... I'm going to get a million letters, but I'm less of a gun control absolutist now that I know how easy it is to subdue and intimidate a population when the state turns violently against unarmed citizens.
There's the headline.
You know, that on the other hand, the resistance had guns. And you cannot overestimate... And I wish everyone would read Professor Weitz's book. It's so timely. You cannot overestimate how easy it is to subdue a whole population when there are paramilitary thugs forcing people to drink emetics, beating newspaper editors, raping women, breaking into people's homes, terrorizing children. You know, people are not that brave when they're faced with gangs of, you know, state terror.
And so broadening out on that comment,
Excuse me, and the colonists knew that.
And from our comments page that says most conservatives, hate the idea of so much power in the hands of the federal government instead of in the states. And we have so many people in the USA with guns and states still have power. So how much do you think, Naomi, briefly, this is a hedge against this kind of state control that you're fearing? Because there is a conservative ethic that also hates that kind of centralized power.
Right. I'm so glad you mentioned that and your emailer. This is so much the essence of a transpartisan issue, just like Professor Weitz's book is a transpartisan warning. All I'm hearing from so many concerned conservatives, evangelicals, libertarians, as well as progressives.
That's where people like Bruce Fein and Bob Barr, diehard
David
Republicans
Keane,
in the past, come in as they raise their voices
as they should
against
be. Look, the founders, we are so far away from the founders' vision. Respectfully, Professor Weitz, your faith in the stability of American democracy was not shared by the founders. The founders totally knew that democracy was fragile and that an American despot could easily arise in America to oppress Americans if checks and balances were weakened.
One other thing, and we're going to run out of time here in a minute with Naomi Wolf, author of The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, and Eric Weitz, author of Weimar Germany, Promise and Tragedy. Anti-war activists or people on the left are not the only ones to invoke the fascist label right now. We have the phrase Islamo-fascists, right? And Professor Weiss, I was struck by some of the similarities between your description of the Nazi Party in the 20s and, dare I say, at Hamas. They organized unemployed young men, offered social services, and the virulent anti-Semitism.
They did indeed, but I don't think Islamo-fascism is a very helpful phrase. I think actually it reflects a certain poverty of political thinking. It means we're looking back to the past for our political understanding, taking the term fascism from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. I think we're actually in a totally new phase of both political and economic and social activity, and we need deeper thinking than, for example, Norman Podhoretz provides with his book titled Islamo-Fascism. I think it shows the poverty of his political thinking at the moment.
Somewhere,
he can only look to the past.
Somewhere between Norman Podhoretz and Hamas lies the answer. Naomi Wolf, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, Eric Weitz, Weimar Germany, Promise and Tragedy, both new books. Do you have any appearances, Naomi? Anything coming up?
Well, something important. We're calling for hearings to investigate crimes committed by the administration, and if we find them, to appoint a special prosecutor, and you can look to AmericanFreedomCampaign.org.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Coming
up in a minute, we'll recap what's been going on at the Middle East Summit this morning And there is some news. There are some developments. And we will have a call-in on whether Oprah Winfrey or anyone else sways your vote when they make an endorsement. Stay tuned.